Of course, we all know who was responsible for Brexit, and for Trump it was the disenchantment of the white working class. Hello. My parents kept me from children who were rough, wrote Stephen Spender. Well, it's a line that's always rather resonated with me because rough was my mother's favourite term for the working class, for those who lived in rough areas and went in for rough games, areas like Bootle and Seaforth rather than, well, you know, Crosby or Blundell Sands. And I suppose that distinction was my childhood introduction to social class, to the idea that our lower middle class family enjoyed some inherent superiority over those families who lived a dozen bus stops nearer to the centre of Liverpool. And then one day, just round the corner in Prince's Avenue, the Dockertys arrived, all seven of them. Well, the Dockertys, they were doubly damned. They were undoubtedly rough, but they were also Irish. They breed like rabbits, a neighbour confided. Race was suddenly as relevant in my life as class. There was, though, one thing that united my parents and the Dockertys and the rough types on polling day. They nearly all voted Labour. Despite their assumed status differences, they recognised that, as relative have-nots, they had a common cause. But how true might that be today? A new study suggests that support for right-wing populism in Europe and elsewhere is particularly strong among those of lower status. Now, the co-author of that research is Noam Gidron, who's fellow at the Niehaus Centre for Globalisation and Governance at Princeton University, from where he now joins me. Noam, it's a fascinating study, and you start from the position, really, that white working class people are at the core of right-wing party support. Tell me about the evidence. Tell me what you did, what you surveyed, what data you looked at.
OK, thanks. So our starting point is that wherever populist right parties gain support, they manage to attract a broad coalition of supporters. Successful populist right-wing parties in Europe and successful populist right-wing candidates in the US are those who actually manage to attract diverse supporters based on diverse reasons, diverse causes. That being said, we also find that across different political contexts, support for the populist right is especially strong among working-class men, among low-educated men.
I mean, you were looking across a dozen democratic countries, I think, in Europe and beyond, weren't you?
Exactly. We are looking at 12 European democracies, both Western democracies and Eastern democracies, using survey data from the last 30 years. And we emphasize the role of status in explaining support for populist right. And what we demonstrate is that the social status of working class men has declined over the last 30 years, and that lower social status is strongly predictive of support for populist right-wing parties across different countries.
Now, when you go into this, tell me why. I mean, you've theorised and explored the reasons why it is that white working class men might feel their status is threatened. Tell me what you came up with.
Right. So current academic discussions of this issue often begin with the question of whether support for the populist right is driven by economic factors or by cultural factors. So on the one side, we have those who make the economic argument, and they emphasize developments such as increased economic inequality. And on the other hand, we have those who make the cultural argument, and they emphasize issues such as perceived threats to national identities or opposition to cultural developments such as increased support for gender equality. And there's a lot of good research coming out of debating the question of whether support for populism is mostly economic or mostly a cultural development. But in this work that I'm doing with Peter Hall, my colleague from Harvard, we are arguing that this is probably the wrong way to pose the question, the wrong question to ask, because we have every reason to believe that both economic and cultural factors explain support for populism.
I mean, you're talking... Let me just interrupt you for a moment, because what you're talking about, I mean, you're talking about the ways in which the disappearance, I think, of decent, stable jobs, that is lowering social esteem among these people, and the trade unions no longer provide protection or a sense of pride, I think, that you'd want to say. And you also, interestingly, link it to gender inequality. In what way?
Exactly. So we think that it's both these economic and these cultural factors that together interact with each other in eroding the basis of social status of low-educated men. And as one key economic development, as you mentioned, is the disappearance of decent jobs for low-skilled workers. And by decent jobs, we mean jobs that provide workers with economic security, but also with a sense of pride, a sense of social standing. And one key cultural development is that of gender norms and the important move toward greater gender equality and the incorporation of women into the labor market. And we have some evidence to suggest that increases in the status of women have probably induced some decline in the status of men, and especially those men who lack other sources of social status, such as high income or a prestigious occupation.
So we're talking about how on all fronts, there are several reasons why something that these working class white men might have been proud of, might have felt a sense of personal pride, that these have been attenuated, these have been diminished.
Exactly. It's not either or, either economic or culture, but exactly their intersection, how they reinforce one another, this economic and cultural development that together erode the social status of low-educated men.
And then you want to say that then coming to the voting patterns, we are talking about these people being more likely to vote for right-wing populist parties than those who are higher up, if you like, the economic chain.
Exactly. So we find that status is very strongly associated with voting patterns. So first of all, those with lower status are simply likely not to vote for anyone, to stay home on election day. Lower social status is associated with political alienation, and many of those with low status simply do not vote. But those who do vote, among those who do vote, support for the populist right is especially strong among those toward the bottom of the status hierarchy, those with medium-low levels of social status. And here it's interesting to note that it's not those at the very bottom, those with no sense of social status, who support the populist right, but rather supporters of the populist right are those who experienced a decline in social status and now fear of falling all the way down.
That's fascinating. Thank you for the moment. I want to bring you back later into the discussion, but I want at this point to bring in my second guest, someone who's also, but from a rather different perspective, considered the proposition that there is a section of the population, this white working class, who have, in the common phrase, been left behind. He's writer, lecturer and broadcaster Kenan Malik. What do you think about this argument about social status, the diminishing status enjoyed by this section of the white working class, this feeling of marginalisation that Noam's talking about?
Well, I think he's right that both economic and cultural factors are important, but I would look at the relationship in a slightly different way. It seems to me that what has happened is that economic changes over the past, not just economic, social, political changes over the past 30 years, have become understood in cultural terms. And there are two issues, I think, that are important. One is that the working class has suffered real material changes to their conditions. And secondly, that these changes have come to be understood in new ways. So those changes, when we're talking about those changes, economic and social changes, such as the decline of manufacturing industry, the rise of austerity policies, the atomization of society, and so on. And political changes, such as the shift of social democratic parties away from their traditional working class constituencies, the erosion of the power of the working class, all of which has marginalised the organised working class. But at the same time, that very marginalisation of the working class has made it much more difficult to understand those changes in economic and political terms. At the same time is that we've come to think of social issues largely through the lenses of identity and culture. And so there are sections of the working class who think about their problems, their marginalisation, their political and economic and social marginalisation in terms of a cultural loss. That's how I'd look
at
the relationship.
Cultural loss in the sense that they've lost something that was working class, do you mean?
Yeah, the organisations, for instance, that used to give them...
The trade unions and...
That's not just trade unions, but the wider organisations as well, that used to give them a sense of belonging, a sense of power, a sense of dignity. All those kinds of organisations have eroded. They've either disappeared or their power and then their influence is very different. You know, 50 years ago, the working class could bring down governments. Now they're treated with contempt and derision. People call them chavs. And that's the change, I think, that's important.
OK, well, Kevin, thank you for the moment. Actually, it's quite interesting to see how this idea, this notion of the left behind, it's not only been adopted by quite a lot of political scientists, but you can even see it entering into popular culture. This is a verse from a fairly recent song whose title, it's rather a nice oxymoron, if you like, the song is called Wasteland of the Free, and it rather perfectly captures the meaninglessness of liberty in an environment devoid of opportunity.
We got CEOs making 200 times the workers' pay. Now fight like hell against raising the minimum wage. If you don't like it, mister, they'll ship your job to some third world country across the sea. And it feels like I am living in the wasteland.
That's Iris DeMont, Living in the Wasteland of the Free. Now, so far in this discussion about what we might call the new face of politics, we've only briefly considered, just touched on the relevance of race. But let me now bring that much more centre stage with the help of my third guest. She is Gurminder Bambara, who's Professor of Postcolonial and Decolonial Studies at the University of Sussex. And she's author of a research article in the British Journal of Sociology, a recent research article with the intriguing title Brexit, Trump and Methodological Whiteness on the Misrecognition of Race and Class. Now, Gurminder, the most obvious contemporary examples of a narrative about white working class discontent relates to Brexit and to Trump's election. Commentators on both spoke of the left behind. Tell me a little about the characterisation of this group and the limitations of this type of analysis as you see them.
Well, I think the left behind as presented within media discourses were typically represented as being white working class voters, most likely from northern towns and cities, people who had been left behind by the processes of economic globalisation, which had benefited some people, but not them. They were held responsible for the Brexit result and for the election of Trump. But if we look at the data, then I don't think that this analysis holds.
What does the data tell us then?
Well, the difficulty here is in terms of the data in part because the only robust data that we have to go on is from the Lord Ashcroft polls. On the day of the referendum, he and his team surveyed over 12,000 people after they'd voted and asked them why they'd voted, and that's the only data that we have really to work on. Danny Dorling, amongst others, has analysed this data, and he suggests by looking at this that 52% of the people who voted for Brexit were from southern England, not from the north, and 59% were from the middle class.
And these people were mainly homeowners, I think, in the south, weren't they?
That's
this proportion, and with secure pensions.
This is, I mean, from the analysis that's been done of this, I mean, together with Lorenzo Antonucci, who's a researcher at Birmingham University, with colleagues, she also did a secondary follow-up analysis of this, where they did a two-stage study asking people to self-identify as working class or middle class and asking them about whether they'd voted for Brexit or not. And their research demonstrated that there was absolutely no correlation between self-identifying as working class and voting Leave, but there was a correlation between identifying as middle class and voting Leave. So it's very clear from the analysis that's been made of this data that the people who voted for Brexit were largely older, they were pensioned, they were propertied, they were the white middle class living in southern England.
So we simply can't use that left behind in the way that we've been talking about it so far. But what about the Trump voters? What do we see here in terms of race class breakdown?
I mean, I think there as well, the data is very similar to the data here in terms of Brexit. Only one third of those who voted for Trump came from the lowest income bracket, that is those people earning below $50,000. The majority of Trump voters were better off Americans. And the swing to Trump was really carried not so much by the white working class in the US, but really the vote of white middle class citizens. And again, here, including college educated white people. There's a really crude understanding of class that's been mobilised in many of the analyses that come out of the US, where not having a college education automatically seems to make people working class. But the issue is that you can not have a college education and also be well off. And so not understanding class properly makes it difficult to provide a good analysis.
And you talk about some evidence of a white working class swing in the Rust Belt states, but that really distorts the full picture.
if we focus only on the Rust Belt states, we're not seeing the full picture. And the full picture is that the swing to Trump really came from the better off within society and disproportionately from white voters. Because if you look, for example, at African-American women, 96% of them voted for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. Now, I want to come on to that because, I mean, you've already demolished a couple of stereotypes about the sort of people who were voting. But you also, as well as a failure to identify the people responsible for delivering the votes for Brexit and Trump, you also suggest that there's been a tendency to leave black and minority ethnic people out of the analysis of that left behind group. Now, expand on that for me. Why do you think it inhibits our understanding of the result?
I mean, in the Brexit debates, the tendency is to represent the white working class as the British working class. But this is empirically problematic. The British working class is made up also of black and brown people and not just white people. So focusing only on white citizens is to suggest that the rest of us are not British and don't matter in the analyses that are put forward. But it also distorts the analysis. For example, the British working class is left behind, but it didn't disproportionately vote for Brexit. Now, whilst not all black and minority ethnic people are working class, we can assume from the figures on racial disadvantage that have been released recently and over, you know, any number of times, that many are. And yet, if we look at the figures, 67% of Asian voters voted Remain, 70% of Muslim voters voted Remain, and 73% of Afro-Caribbean and black British citizens voted Remain.
So this sits along what you were saying before about the vast majority of poor African-Americans voting for Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. So really, if we're talking about left behind, we might want to say this group certainly constitutes what might be regarded as left behind. But in fact, in terms of voting, they really are not voting for Brexit or voting indeed for Trump.
No. And I think that's why the analysis needs to take their voting, how they voted into account in order to have a better analysis of what the issues are and how we might resolve them.
Now, there's a great deal of talk about identity politics. In the context of trying to explain Trump's victory, it was argued that the Democratic liberal elites were too focused on politically correct ideas about race and gender at the expense of class. So this was alienating the white working class male vote. You know, they didn't want to hear so much about race and gender and political correctness and the right words that should be used. Tell me about your take on this.
Well, I'd like to pick up here on something that Noam mentioned, because in the discussion of subjective low status, the evidence that's provided by him and his colleague in the article is really about the gains made by women over the corresponding period.
Yes.
And yet the blame, if you like, is being placed at the feet of ethnic minorities, both here and in the States. So if you're looking at what it is that people are voting for, and you're talking about them voting for right-wing populist parties, well, that suggests that the problem, if you want to put it in those terms, is with minorities or immigrants. But the only evidence that they present in their paper for the decline in the subjective social status for white working-class men is the rise in women's objective socioeconomic conditions. So then why buy into the narrative of scapegoating minorities? And this ties into the larger point that I make in my paper, that it's the refusal of social scientists to rigorously look at the available data and to analyse it in its own terms, as opposed to in relation to preconceived frames that don't see black and brown people as equal citizens.
Now, it's interesting, you've got a reference to people may recall a programme in which I interviewed the American sociologist Arlie Hochschild, who'd done a sort of study. She'd left Berkeley University and she'd gone across to study white right-wing voters in the state of Louisiana. She wanted to see exactly what they were up to, what they were feeling about the world, how they were likely to vote. And she uses a metaphor which she created to capture these people's sense that others were getting ahead of them, the line cutters.
You're waiting in line as in a pilgrimage, and the top of the hill is the American dream, and the line hasn't moved, and your feet are tired, and you feel a deserving for this American dream. People I interviewed, you know, hadn't had a raise in 2 decades. And then you see line cutters who seem to be sponsored by President Obama. And then someone ahead of the line turns around, more educated than you, because you're blue collar, and insults you as a redneck.
Let me put it like this. I think in a way you want to take issue with what might be called this sad story.
Yes, I have a number of points at which I disagree with Ali Hochschild's analysis. I mean, first, in terms of the language that she uses of line cutters, I think line cutters is a rather derogatory way of discussing measures that were brought about during the civil rights period to try and address the historic injustices of two centuries of enslavement followed by segregation organized around racial lines. So if we're talking about a line, we have to remember that this was a line that was historically constituted through segregation, where white people had access to opportunities that black African American people didn't have at that time. Secondly, the main beneficiaries of affirmative action have been middle-class white women, such as Hochschild herself, and not African-Americans or the other minorities that she's then blaming for the conditions of working-class white people in the US. And thirdly, she seeks to present the white working class as having been strangers in their own land, but this doesn't take into consideration that what they're reacting to is that they consider these others as strangers who ought not to have access to equal rights. So I think this is really problematic, particularly when she goes on to discuss their grievances as legitimate grievances. So I don't contest the fact that people have grievances, but I contest the legitimacy of those grievances, because what does the legitimacy rest in?
It's just almost like a hierarchy of grievances, and we're talking here. This is not in the top echelon of the hierarchy of grievances. Let me bring you back in again, Kenan, now. Now, you've been listening to Gurminder. I mean, do you agree there has been too much focus on talking about the white working class being responsible for Brexit and Trump, given, as we've heard, the figures don't really bear this out?
Well, it's true, if you look at Brexit and the Trump vote, that the middle class was significant in the Brexit vote, and that the majority of the working class did not vote for Trump. But I think just to look at it in that way is to miss the point. If you take America, for instance, the majority of the working class traditionally vote Democrat, and it did so again this time. What was significant in 2016 was that not the absolute figures, but the changes that took place, so that a much higher proportion of working-class voters and of those at the bottom of the income scale voted for Trump in 2016 than voted for Romney in 2012. And even, I mean, it's striking, even African-Americans who almost 100%, something like between 90 and 95% voted for Clinton. Nevertheless, Trump received a higher proportion of the African-American vote than Romney did in 2012. So to say that most working-class voters voted for Clinton in 2016 is to reiterate what we've known for a long time. But to say that a swing, a majority or a larger proportion of working class voted for Trump than voted for Romney in 2012 is to look at something new. And similarly with Brexit.
It's yes, I was going to ask you about Brexit. Yeah, I mean, here we expect the Shire Tories to vote as they do.
Exactly. But what was interesting enough, I'm not suggesting that the middle class vote wasn't important or wasn't the key, played a key role in the Brexit vote. But what is significant was that large sections of the working class in the north, in South Wales, for instance, did vote Leave. Traditional Labour supporters who, you know, from one perspective, one might have expected to vote Remain, did not. And so it's important to ask why they did not and to look at the reasons that they felt necessary to vote Leave.
Now, you also, you want to say, Gurminder was suggesting that if we're going to understand the victory of Trump, we've got to look at racialised identity rather than class. You'd accept that argument?
Well, I think it's important to recognise how racialised identities have come about. It goes back to the point I was making earlier in relation to Non, that the economic and political marginalisation of sections of the working class has come to be seen as a cultural loss, in cultural terms, largely because the only language we have through which to think about these identities is that of identity. I mean, we think about these issues of change in terms of identity. So class identity has become a cultural or even a racial attribute. And I think what the debate really shows is that different ways in which we think of what belonging or what binds together white and non-white population. So we think about minorities as belonging to almost classless communities. And, you know, it's 40 years now since the Grunwick strike, the 40th anniversary of the Grunwick strike. And in the 70s, there was much greater level of racism within the labour movement than there is now. But yet nobody suggested that black or Asian workers weren't an integral part of the working class. Today, racism is much less than it was 40 years ago. And yet we have a racialised cleavage, if you like, where we think about the working class largely in terms of whites. And so, you know, minorities belong to communities. The white population is riven by class. And yes. I think that's the problem.
And this is very much sort of picking up, I mean, Gaminda's point that white working class people are only experiencing what black and minority ethnic people have experienced over a longer period of time. I mean, if we're going to talk about left behind, we have other groups we need to pay attention to.
I don't like the word left behind, left behind, because it suggests a value judgment as well as a kind of empirical category. But yes, we should be concerned about the fact that black and Asian workers have been suffering from poor conditions for a very long time, and not just from poor conditions, from racism. But the fact that we should be concerned about the conditions faced by black and Asian workers and about the racism they face doesn't mean that we should not be concerned also by the conditions or the changing conditions faced by white workers. And that there's a tendency often to dismiss the grievances of white workers because they are white.
Let me, Noam, I hope you're still there. I just wanted to ask you about this idea, you're arguing about to combat the appeal of right-wing populism, social status needs to be restored a bit to predominantly working-class men. But, I mean, given we've been hearing that status loss might in a part be linked to greater gender and racial equality, I mean, don't we just say, well, it's hard luck? I mean, should we be pandering to people who feel somehow alienated on these grounds?
I don't think at all that we need to take a step back from policies of greater inclusion and equality in terms of gender or racial identities. I do think that we need to think seriously about how we can address these challenges of social integration, this challenge of providing a sense of social status and social esteem to people from all walks of life and to all members of society. And I think that should be high on our priority.
And Gaminda, what about this? Do you think we should perhaps stop talking about the white working class as a category altogether in order to come up with solutions which address the grievances of working class people as a whole, perhaps?
Well, one of the reasons we address that category is because it's about who do we understand as the legitimate object of public policy. And only those who can demonstrate historical belonging to the nation are seen to be the legitimate objects of public policy. But Britain hasn't historically been a nation, it's been imperial. And so the constituency of public policy is broader. So I just finish with what I said before, that the British working class is not only white.
OK, Gaminda Bamborough and Kenan Malik and Noam Godwin, thank you all very much. We had lots of people writing in about natural health foods. Someone wrote in and said that I shouldn't have attacked G.B. Hauser, who 70 years ago spoke out against the ills of sugar and white bread. He tells me all these people, Marlene Dietrich, Paulette Goddard, Gloria Swanson, Greta Garbo, who all lived until they were 90. It's a persuasive message. I still prefer Ronnie Scott's advice, forget healthy food. The only way to stay looking younger is to hang around with older people. As long, of course, he said with a mild sigh, there are still some left. Well, I do hope you enjoyed that programme. And if you'd like to hear something similar, why not try downloading the In Our Time podcast at bbc.co.uk/radio4.